Guru Nation, welcome to episode 787 of Random Musings from the Clinical Trials Guru. In this episode, I actually talk to Robert Goldman and Chris Sauber, who are regular co-hosts now. And Robert is from the sponsor side, Chris is my business partner, and obviously on the site side, we get into business development for sites, and it leads into an interesting conversation about the state of private practice physicians. So check it out. Hopefully you find something interesting here. I wanted to give a shout out to our sponsors. The first one is Inato. Shout out to Inato. It is a free platform for getting studies. Speaking of business development, I'm on there constantly now, maybe on my third study now that I've gotten through them for free, no cost, no hidden fees or anything. You do need previous therapeutic area expertise. This actually comes up in the podcast as well. So check out Inato, link in the show notes. Also, Creo, shout out to Creo, eSource, eReg, CTMS, auto texting. You only pay for what you use, which is very important. Check them out, and hopefully you enjoy this episode. Guys,
Morning, good morning.
good morning. From sun up to sundown. We're gonna go Guru Nation after dark once a month, I think.
24/7, huh?
24/7 live stream. We're not far from that, especially with those Apple VR. Have you guys seen that, by the way?
I saw some dude talking about it, and he's like, "This is not really me. This is my avatar talking for me," or some crap. I was like, "This
Yeah.
can't be real."
No, it's
Is it real?
real. It's coming. It's like if we all wore one right now, we would think we're in the same room, and the pod would look like we are in the same room, like the recording.
Yeah.
So that's coming. Whether it's good for society or not, I mean, like any technology, everyone hates it at first and then they just start using it. But that's already here. It's not that it's coming. It's actually already here. They actually did a good product to you. But give it a year or two for the research applications to pop up. You'll start getting these things at your site instead of the tablets. Give this to your patient, put it on their head.
We'll be
Then
having
they'll
any
feel like they're in the
classes.
clinic with you, and you can do IP accountability as a CRA, like in the same room.
What scares the crap out of me about
Wow.
that? This is kind of off on a tangent, but boy, it'll be easy to frame you for a crime, right? Because everything looks real. It's like here's video of him
Yeah.
robbing the store.
I'm sure they'll have tools. Like, this is why technology ultimately is good, because it stimulates the economy. So there's going to be counter tools. Like, this is going to prove that that one's fake. There's
Oh,
always
hopefully
like,
that exists.
yeah, there's controls and balances too. I mean, you can't leave everything up to the government, but industry takes care of a lot of its own problems until lobbyists come in and then kind of kill it. But let's not get too far off topic, man. This
What
is
is the topic?
the topic is business development and getting studies,
Yeah,
right?
that's a good one.
Like the sites are booming still, and I was on a Zoom call this morning, potentially an advisor for a company that wants to help facilitate matchmaking and study startup process, and
So,
biz dev is alive and well, and but sites don't do it well. Robert and Chris and myself, we know. I mean, even us, we're sometimes guilty of just pray and spray, copy and paste.
I do have a question.
Yeah.
It's directed at Robert, but maybe it's better to cover later or now. I don't know. It should be brief, but
Now.
well, it's not about sites. It's more from a CRO perspective because we take these calls often. Hey, as a CRO, how do I get more studies? I assume Robert has some idea on how that works. Would that be better now or later?
Let's save
Now.
that for a minute. Let's save that for a minute because I want to say something here.
Okay.
I got a call yesterday myself. I actually texted you about this, Dan. And it was a established network. They're looking for additional studies in certain therapeutic areas. They wanted to recruit additional PIs, etc. And it's such a Dan, you say sites are booming. They are, right? But here's the thing. I see a lot of work being backburnered because of lack of funding or, you know, programs being delayed or whatever. So I'm just saying, you know, there's very well-known people in the industry who are site owners who are finding themselves in a pickle when it comes to expansion, you know, new studies, especially new PIs. You know, that is a very difficult topic to broach. So of course I, you know, gave this individual your information, Chris, you know, and, you know, hoping that we can assist because they are, you know, kind of friends of the family, if you will. And, you know, hopefully, you know, you guys can assist them in obtaining new study opportunities. But, you know, if they came to me and said, hey, do you have any new study? Like, I don't, you know, and I wouldn't even know where to get them. On the other hand, going but to your question.
You're working at a sponsor, right? They have
correct.
A limited funnel, right? Whereas a CRO should be a little bit more vast, I would think, right? They have many projects.
So that's another thing, right? So I'm very well acquainted, let's call it, with the president and CEO of a company. I would call them a fairly newer CRO. You know, and I had a call with him not too long ago, and, you know, I'm not a sales guy. That's obviously not my area of expertise, but, you know, the conversation was had, hey, if you can help us with your network, you know, get some studies, you know, we would pay you a percentage and compensate you. Mm-hmm. It sounds phenomenal, but I wouldn't know where to be. It's very difficult, guys, as a sponsor to, you know, pivot your pipeline of work when you have a relationship with an established organization. There's a lot of efficiencies in terms of costing when you continue to do work with that company, even if there's QA problems, use problems, design problems, you're going to have that anywhere. Clinical trials are messy inherently. They always will be, unfortunately, no matter what tax solution comes out, there's always going to be some sort of, you know, issue to put out or think about daily. So with that said, go ahead, Chris.
So once you've developed as a sponsor a relationship with a CRO, you really need to be incentivized to move on to a different CRO.
Right. Because- and even when things go bad or sideways, okay? I mean, your last ditch resort is going to be, you know what, I'm pulling this study from the CRO and I'm going to give it to this CRO. That's a 6-month delay with your, you know, for sure. Yeah. And you have to weigh out the, you know, the risk benefit ratio of making a very drastic decision like that.
Yeah. Because as you had mentioned, which I never considered, the sponsor has developed a relationship with the CRO. So they have procedures in place. The costs are mitigated because they don't have to redevelop this with a new CRO. Yeah. Makes sense. And just to clarify something you mentioned about this site network, so the hierarchy of difficulty in research from a site perspective is PI is the easiest aspect, right? Getting a PI, then getting studies, then getting patients, just FYI.
So maybe we can talk about that because, you know, I find it quite difficult to approach a, you know, let's say a PI with, you know, 5 to 10 years of clinical experience, not even research experience. I'm just talking practice, you know. Mm-hmm. On their own, whether they're working for a hospital or they have their own private practice. Obviously, if you're going to look for a new PI, you want to target a private practice. Mm-hmm. What's the pitch, Chris? How do you make their ears perk? I mean, obviously, the financial is one aspect of it, but a lot of these doctors I talk to personally, they don't want to hear anything about it.
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely a factor.
But yet you say it's the easiest aspect of it. So
it's the easiest of the three, right?
Okay.
So it's the easiest of the three, but it's not easy, right? Mm-hmm. Like Dan and I have gone door knocking, literally door knocking for PIs.
Right? And that's what it takes, right? I mean, that's what I would imagine.
Actually, I think that's the least effective way to go about it.
I don't think the least, but yeah, it's not as effective as...
It's very time-consuming for the results. I think Dan and I did this for 8 hours one day, and I think we talked to two doctors, one of which had no interest whatsoever in research, and one did.
But one did, you know? And that's...
Yeah, but they didn't follow through.
Of course.
So your ROI on that 8 hours was zero.
Exactly. No, it was a potential one. I think if we would have followed up more, it could have worked.
So what is the best way to recruit a new PI?
Network? Well, starting with your own network, right? Well, yeah. And you have a network, right? You see a doctor.
That's right.
Right. So start there. Start with your own doctor. Then ask him if he has any of his colleagues. Sorry, Dan. Ask him if any of his colleagues would be interested or her colleagues.
Before we moved to Yuma, Dora, my wife, I had her do it. You know, hey, map out like all the doctors in Yuma that work for themselves, not for the hospital. And then she started contacting them by email. A few got back. Then the ones that didn't, that she said, hey, this one didn't reply back, but he has a really good reputation. That ended up being Dr. Smith. I got lucky that he was on LinkedIn and I had LinkedIn Premium. So I inboxed him there. So it was like a group effort, like, hey, let's do a pray and spray, but then let's target like sniper, like get in there and snipe, you know, him, like a message on LinkedIn. I would have gone in person to go see him too, because I'm trying to snipe him, because that was one we wanted. Chris and I initially partnered with someone else who in hindsight didn't work out. He had some, like attitude
issues. He was quirky.
He was like kind of not someone you necessarily want to partner with. Let's just put it that way. But he did. He would have been a viable PI as well. It's just not as good a situation.
Yep. I'll be right back, guys.
Okay.
Right.
But that's how it worked out with the PI here. But to Robert's point, I mean, there is no easy way.
It's work.
It's work. And there's like you can map it out. I know some sites that send letters to doctor's offices, like, hey, I used to get these letters because at our site it was also a private practice, so these competing sites would try to recruit our physicians like to join their network. I would of course throw those in the mail, right, or throw those in the trash right away. But there are strategies. There's pray and spray, and then there's highly targeted ones, and the highly targeted ones tend to work better. But even with Dr. Smith, it took 2 months for him to reply. Like, I actually forgot I sent him the message, and then we were well on our way with the other guy when Smith replied, and we were already seeing some issues with the other guy, and we said, hey, remember I asked you, hey, we should pivot, you know, move from this dude to Smith, and you were like, yeah, you got the same vibes too, I think.
Yeah.
From the other guy.
Yeah, he was quirky.
Yeah. So, I mean, it could have still worked, but it wouldn't have been ideal, I think.
You're correct. I completely agree. Not nearly as beneficial as Smith is.
No.
And to the next point, right? So once you have a PI, it becomes way easier to get your next sub-I or PI. Right. I think Dan can attest to this and I can too. So from our PI in San Bernardino, we've gotten a second PI as well as a sub investigator, right? Because they have colleagues, these doctors do.
Correct. Correct.
So once you get that first one, it's much easier to get the second.
Exponentially easier, because now you're not going in cold. You're asking your PI that you have a relationship with, hey, who are some of your colleagues that you know to do these kind of indication studies? Yep. And they'll tell you. That's how we got all of our other, after Smith, that's how we got our next four PIs. Yep. All through him. Like all of them.
Same thing in San Bernardino, right? So we got a sub-investigator and a PI.
And one of our PIs in San Bernardino was my doctor.
Yeah.
And
the newest one.
The newest one, and I talked to, and the most promising one. And I was a patient at their clinic. I talked to his staff. I like to talk in the offices. I was bored and they were like not that busy, but the doctor wasn't there. So we were all just waiting for him to show up. So I was like, I saw on their calendar San Bernardino, and I was like, ah, interesting. I got an office there too, but we were all in Orange County. And they said, oh, yeah, he's actually looking for a bigger place. And I said, really? Well, we are also looking for a doctor to rent from us. We have a big place. And that's how that worked.
And there you go. That's effectively a testimony to working your network.
Yeah. Yeah. And that was my loose, like, that was my definitely my extended network. It's not like I knew these people well.
Yeah, but I knew them well enough. Network.
Yeah, they were the MAs, and it was in my sphere of influence at that time. I think I had a few visits there already. It wasn't my first visit, but I was comfortable with the MAs already, and that's how it worked. And he had objections. I don't normally like to partner with patients, but in your case, I make an exception, and you know, all like the regular things you would expect. It's not like he just said yes. No, he said no.
It's the sales. This is sales, and you have to sell.
Yeah.
It's not going to just flop into your lap like a dead fish. You have to sell to it to capture it, right?
Well, the other one I hate, Chris. I don't know how you feel about this, but I made a video about this yesterday on YouTube.
Okay.
People talking about this and saying, do you know someone who – do you have a contract, a good contract where I could lock down my PI? As if they want to trap them.
Like they're a slave or something.
Like they're a slave or like they're a prisoner. Like, do you have a good contract that I could lock down my PI?
I get that a lot, man. I get that a lot.
That's why I had to make that video. You already lost if that's your mentality. Yeah. Like the PI, you know what locks the PI down? It's not your $8,000 contract you paid an attorney. It's the 1572. That's what locks your PI down.
Well, it's really more the tripartite contract.
Well, that too. When you actually get a study, that's what locks the PI down as well. But the FDA also is on your side, actually.
Well, yes, of course. But I guess it's part and parcel, right? The two work in combination, the contract and the 1572, because you're listed on both as the company.
I mean, guys, I don't mean to interject here. I've seen PIs, and this happened to me literally like 3 or 4 months ago. I mean, I get a phone call from a site. Hey, this PI just, they're gone. We have a new PI assuming. Like, I mean, I don't know, Dan, because, you know, if it's, I guess it depends on experience and risk aversion and what the PI thinks. But there are PIs out there who just get up and walk away, and they're just like, they don't care.
But they can do that.
We've had this happen, Dan and I have had this happen. Yeah.
So I mean, is it right for us to say that the 1572 is locking them down? I don't know.
Well, I mean, we can't enforce it as private citizens, but the FDA is the one that can go after the PI and say, hey,
what's the likelihood of that though, really, Dan? You know,
well, it's low.
Right. That's my
point. What else can you do? Like, you know, the whole thing is like, yeah, like the best strategy is not to get a PI like that. Like, try to find those red flags early. And we almost had a PI like this, I think, in Yuma. I mean, if I would extend this thread, he may have been one of those guys that said, I don't want to do it anymore. I'm over it. And we kind of saw those early warning signs. And that was around the same time Smith replied back to my LinkedIn message. And we pivoted. Me and Chris were on a Zoom call just like this and saying, hey, I think we should like move on. And Chris is like, yeah, no, I think you're right.
But Robert, what you're bringing up is a different scenario than what Dan and I were speaking of, right? So what you're talking about is that what sites are concerned about is the doctor pulling studies from them, right? These individuals, like a former coordinator who's starting a site, has their PI. Hey, yeah, how do I get the PI not to take, you know, once we start this business, to take my business from me? Right. That's their concern. And what protects them there is, as Dan said, the 1572. But I really think it's more the contract personally, because that contract, the sponsor can't just break it. They have to, if the PI wants out of that contract, they have to give permission. Right. Or vice versa. If the site wants out of the contract, they have to give permission to be removed from the contract. So there's legalities involved that the sponsor is not going to break without permission.
Chris, is the is the PI always the signatory on the contract?
They're always a signatory. They either have to, they're either part of the contract or they're signing as read and acknowledged, right? One or the other. Now, read and acknowledged is different than being a party to the contract. So if they're reading and acknowledging the contract, I don't know how that works. I think there's a little more leeway there in which they can be removed from the contract.
Yeah.
But if they're a party to the contract, no, they can't just be removed.
Sure. Sure. Yeah. I think I'll say this to say this, you know, I think it's difficult. I know, Chris, you mentioned it's easiest of the three components.
It is. I didn't say it was easy. Yeah. It's the easiest of the three.
Yeah. But so it's hard. I mean, it's hard work, but you should wake up every day and do hard things anyways. Mm-hmm. You know, yeah. I mean, that's the mantra, but, PI, you know, new PIs, bringing them in. And then from the sponsor perspective, if you have a green PI, then as a site, you're faced with convincing, you know, a sponsor stakeholder or a CRO stakeholder for that matter, hey, this PI doesn't have industry experience per se, but we have a, you know, very experienced staff. You kind of need one or the other to enable a sponsor or a CRO to take a leap of faith. Because guys, you got to remember something here. And again, I don't mean for this to be negative. You know, I just want to have a real transparent, candid conversation so that we can really dig through the weeds here. How does a green site, whether it's a green PI or green staff with an experienced PI, convince a CRO or a sponsor to give them a shot? You know, that's a challenge. And for me, you know, you look at the qualifications of the staff under the PI, and one or the other has to jive. Because when you go to a CRO, and I don't care if it's a small CRO, midsize, or the large ones, I've worked for them. You know, sponsors will come with their 15, 20 preferred sites that they've worked with in the past that have done good. They're familiar with the product, but the rest of the feasibility work to secure whatever number of sites they need for whatever study they're doing comes from within the CRO. It's not me just searching on LinkedIn for sites or talking to friends about sites. So how do you get on that list? I don't even know the answer to that, to be very honest with you. You know, we go to our site, you know, organization within the CRO, and we ask for a list, and, you know, you get this insane skill, you know, the spreadsheet of sites you work with.
For the green sites, not every study is the same. Like, there's good studies, there's bad studies, there's studies from hell that no one really wants to do.
And that's what research naive physicians get.
Usually they get the studies they no one is able to enroll on.
Nobody wants.
Well, the people think they want it, and then they're like, yeah, it's way harder than I thought. I have 10 more studies. Let's just move our focus here. Mm-hmm. So what happens? You need rescue sites, right? And that's where the newer PIs come in, because Robert, the one thing they do have to offer, you hope they have the infrastructure in place. That's where you got to do your due diligence. Like, they have to at least check the boxes in case mm-hmm. you get audited. Why the hell do you pick this site? Well, they mm-hmm. got these minimum things. PI is naive or relatively inexperienced, but their coordinator, you know, this and that. You can make it work.
Sure.
What's to say they can't enroll either, but they have a higher chance of enrolling because that's like their only study. So they're focused on that study, right? And then that opens them up. Now they're no longer research naive. Yep. And now they can start getting good studies. So first study you're going to get is probably a bad one.
Let me play the devil's advocate. Usually, guys, I don't do this. You know that, you know?
Love devil advocate.
Okay, so now you
love the devil, Dan?
You love the devil, Dan.
No.
So you have this green research naive PI who got this, you know, insanely hard study to enroll, kind of a leftover because nobody else wants it type of a deal, right? We all agree so far. Yep. Now this PI's experience, first exposure is horrific. And they're like, you know what? This is a terrible experience. Dan, you've had PIs like this on your show. So my point is, you know, man, it's really a double-edged sword, in my opinion. You know, you have you got a study that's really challenging unbeknownst to the PI because they may or may not realize why they were even awarded it to begin with. We understand
But that's where the site owner comes in and tells them beforehand, this study's going to suck.
You hope.
Yeah, you should if you're the site owner. You need to communicate. Yeah. This study's going to suck. Here's why we're getting it.
Yep.
It's going to make it easier to get other studies. And if we can enroll anyone, that's icing on the cake.
There you go. That's the missing link right there. So it's that communication. 100%.
It's the responsible site owners. Like, a lot of these site owners don't know what they're doing. They're the same ones that try to lock in their PIs with crazy contracts. Like, they're not your prisoner. They could leave. You know, LinkedIn user, I think this is Dr. Fox. He says the IRB will go after the PI before the FDA will. OHRP will track a PI no matter where they what they do. Read and understood. PI is employee of site. They are not bound, but site is and is responsible for contacting sponsor to let them know if PI is unable to serve. In university, there's a high fluctuation of doctors, so also PIs. And PI grooming equals start them on the bunny slopes. Well, we're starting them on the expert advanced slopes. And we don't really get down very far. You know, we take like the ski lift back down maybe. But you still get that study. And for your next study, when they ask you, do you have previous experience in this indication? You can now say yes. Now, the next question, which is a distant second, is how many did you enroll? And then you could say, well, it was a tough study. No one really enrolled anything. We screened 4 and screened failed 0. Then the sponsor's like, okay, well, probably was a tough study. We don't like that it's 0, but hey, at least they tried and at least they have the experience. We'll give them this study. And that's how you get the ball rolling. That's literally how it happened in Yuma clinical trials, literally how it happened in South Coast clinical trials, breakthrough clinical trials. What other clinical trial you want to do in the future too? My opinion, but the responsible site owners, not site owners that try to control, try to say, I'm going to lock you in, Dr. So-and-so, like, and you're going to do what I say. Chris and I have been on numerous calls with these people who are just, I think, irrational when it comes to dealing with their PIs. Like, so they actually don't belong in this business.
Did you catch that roll of the eyes to the top there that Dan did? He had to find a correct word for what he was trying to think of. Something else came to mind initially.
Yeah.
To describe these people.
Exactly right. It's really troubling. And then to Robert's point, there are some doctors who don't belong in research. And if you're the business owner, you're an entrepreneur, you're literally going in the face of risk. Odds are against you as is. You're going to fail. Why would you pick? Why do you not recognize red flags in these PIs? Like, and that comes with experience, I think. But like, there's some red flags. Like, if the guy or gal is like unpleasant to deal with, it's not going to get any easier.
Oh, it gets worse.
Like, yeah. So if they're already unpleasant to deal with, you know, it's going to get way worse. What happens when you get your first deviation? Or they have to sign a stack of labs like this big because the labs print like one result per page. Like, what's going to happen then?
They're going to blow a gasket.
Yeah, they're going to leave you, and then you got to find the OHRP to go chase them down.
Yeah, sign it yourself, buddy.
Yeah, but so the PI first, then studies. It's, look, a lot of entrepreneur. SOS, we met so many people wanting to start sites, and I'm so happy to like to confirm that the majority of these people, I think, are in the right headspace. Probably because people that go to SOS already have the right mentality, I think.
I just thought of another conference idea that I'm gonna have to private message you guys both real quick with. That would be an amazing idea.
Let's do it. I'm down. Keep in mind, doctors are really sensitive to being controlled by private equity-owned healthcare systems. Yeah. We're not even talking about that. Yeah. They want to be controlled by, like, random Joe Schmo, the entrepreneur. You know, I worked in legal at a Pfizer, so now I want to start a site. Chris and I dealt with these people. They're out of their mind. They think that everything is, like, every organization behaves like Pfizer. It's not the case. And these doctors, you're absolutely right. That's the last thing they want, especially if they have a busy private practice, is someone telling them what to do or dictating how they're going to work, what they need to do. No, you need to give them leeway. You know how many contracts I have with my five PIs here in Yuma? Zero. Now, we got study contracts. Yeah, plenty. Contract between me and them? None. Why? It's a handshake.
I mean, Dan, to your point, you know, well, I think...
Sorry, real quick, just...
Yeah.
The contract is the study you get, right?
Thank you. Yes.
Okay, go on.
No, I was just gonna say, you know, I think with the PIs and not wanting to be controlled by VC and private equity, I think it all goes back to Dan's point, the transparent site owner. You know, like having those upfront discussions from the beginning, you know, making sure the PI understands their obligations on the back of the 1572. I think a lot of those conversations are difficult to have upfront in a new setting. Because you know, you don't want to scare the PI off and you want to ensure the business gets launched and you got this study. And if you say the wrong thing, you know, he or she may do one or the other, and it could backfire. So a lot of site owners, I would imagine, tread very carefully and then begin once the thing starts. Now they start to have this micromanaging behavior, which PIs will not tolerate. So I just think it all goes back to your point, Dan, informed, transparent communications from site owner to the PI, whether it's a crappy study, whether it's their obligations, what could go wrong, what could go right, pros and cons. Just having a open, transparent conversation, I think, is critical to the mission.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I know, so Dan's not too involved with clients any longer, but in the past, I mean, we used to take calls of people, hey, I'm going to lose my PI for this, that, or the other reason. And I know Dan's big thing to harp on was communication, which
Over-communicate. Here's the thing. A lot of these people that want to start sites are get-rich-quick people. Like, hey, I'm tired of being a CRA. I want to start a site. So they think that they're going to start screening. By the time their brain decides to be a site owner, that they're going to start screening in a month, and that checks come in like another month. And that's not the case. Like, I have five PIs right now. I only have studies for three of them. Two are brand new. I just got them like in the last quarter. I'm communicating with them weekly via text, via phone. That way they see I'm working. I take screenshots of like the screen. Hey, is this study good for you? No. Yes. Okay. Can you get a class one license? No. Okay. They see that I'm doing stuff. They don't just see that I'm sitting back doing nothing and then they forget about me. And by the time I get someone that wants to give me a study, they're like, who is this guy? I forgot. I even talked to him. What is this? So no, every week this, you like this? No. Yes. Okay. Do you know this one's not for me? That's what we do with Smith. Smith was such a good catch. I went in person every week and he even told me, why are you doing all these meetings? And I said, well, we just want to make sure we're on the same page where we start. Like, he was over it already. Like, why are you doing so many meetings? But 5 minutes, just so he sees that I'm there and doesn't forget about me. Now I'm less needy, I guess. So I just do it through text, but they see that we're working.
But yeah, but not only that, you've established a relationship and there's really no need for those intermittent.
But I'll say I met Dr. Smith in his early days of becoming a PI, right, Dan?
Yeah.
Would you agree?
Yeah.
But Dr. Smith, I think, honestly, is an exception to the general rule. Dr. Smith was a very engaged PI from the beginning. He literally sat through almost the entire SIV presentation, which is, I mean, I was blown away. I'm like, and not only just sitting there, he was engaged in asking questions and, you know, yeah. I mean, you don't see that as often because when PIs become more complacent in their role and they have all this experience, well, I've done 200 plus trials. Yeah. They pop in for 10 minutes and they're out.
Right.
So that might be key though there, Robert, what you just said. When a PI is new, research naive, they may be more interested initially, no? Just because they are new to it and they want to understand what's going on.
I think that's just Dr. Smith's personality. I think because he's...
You don't think that's true of all doctors?
I don't.
When they're research naive, they spend more time to learn the process?
No, not necessarily.
No?
I don't think so either.
I just think Dr. Smith is that type of a guy. Like, he just does things above reproach, and he's, you know, super interested in the science. I believe that. And I think that he has the right mindset. And again, he may be a unicorn in that respect.
Do you know the first thing he asked me when I messaged him on LinkedIn about, I wish I could pull it up. It's going to take me a while, but I said, hey, you know, we do studies. I want to bring studies to Yuma. The first thing he asked me, how much does it cost the patients? That's the first thing he asked me.
There you go. See what I mean?
The first thing. I said, no, actually, they get paid. What do you mean? What does it cost them? And then he was all in. He's like, okay, then we can talk. Come in, you know, come into my office on this day. We could talk. So he had patient first. He is patient first doctor, period. Research or private practice doesn't matter. It's patient first. I do think the majority of doctors at least try to be that way. But to Chris's point, Robert, like maybe after a few studies, they let their past performance do the talking for them. Do you think that's also fair to say, like, hey, I don't need to sit through this whole thing now. Like, we've done three osteoarthritis trials. I'll go for 10 minutes and that's it. Like, then I'll leave. But let our past work speak for ourselves at this point.
I agree with you 100%. I agree with you 100%. I don't think that they need to be there. Because
I think he was interested in your drug, but we can't get into that.
Yeah.
That's an interesting thing. Like that's an outlier of a,
it was a unique situation, but I just, you know, I admire Dr. Smith for that reason. And you know, I think just any sponsor that would work with Dr. Smith would be delighted to work with him because he really does have the oversight needed, that you would expect. And then in conjunction with, you know, your knowledge at the site level, Dan, as a director of your site, I mean, it's kind of a match made in heaven, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it really is some of the top notch research out there. I'm not tooting your horn here. I'm just telling you, you know, in all honesty, and this is only pertaining to my experiences with Dr. Smith. Right. Mm-hmm. But again, you know, I think there's a lot of different personalities out there. Some people are just different. And then there's PIs who have done 200 trials and they sit through the whole SIB consistently till this day. I also had that PI who I just learned lives in my neighborhood, by the way. Very unusual.
There you go. You gonna recruit him or he's already working somewhere?
they own a large research site not too far from where I am right now.
See, when you're the PI owner,
yeah,
I think it's different also.
Yeah.
And how so, Dan? Well, just like an owner, like if you go to a restaurant and the server is also the owner, you're probably gonna get better service. You know,
Great analogy.
Just tells me, and you've seen these, I've been in these situations. It's the same thing. Like you can't expect your employees to care more than you do about your business. And a lot of these people that try to lock in, that's what they're expecting. And like, what makes you so special?
Like, let me ask you a question.
Yeah.
Both of you. This is for both of you guys. Cause I really don't know the answer to this. I mean, I can assume all I want, but you know, make assumptions that don't mean anything.
This is what we want. Sponsors and sites unite and communicate.
100%. But here's my question. Why don't we see more physicians who are business owners of their own site versus entrepreneurs come in and essentially, as to the point of a previous comment, are now employees of the site? Why don't we see more of those?
It goes back to this comment. Private equity, large health systems, take research out of it because I think it's complex. Private practice, you don't see enough anymore.
True. You're right.
Why? As soon as they get out of med school, they've got what, $300,000 debt? Kaiser Permanente, Chris, remember in California, we're trying to recruit
$400,000.
Me and Chris were trying to recruit new psychiatrists. Our current PI psychiatrist sucked. Didn't do anything, was not one we should have partnered with. He even said, hey, try to find another psych. Okay, we go. Brand new, out of med school. They got to be hungry, right? Well, I'm not going to work for you. Kaiser Permanente offered me $400,000 out the bat, like just like that, out of med school.
Yep.
So how can you compete? And they have no incentive to be private practice. Plus, the large health systems are driving down Medicare costs the same way Walmart drove out mom-and-pop grocery stores out of neighborhoods. We'll just keep dropping prices and pay for it until you go out of business. And then we'll raise them back up when we're by ourselves.
Yeah, how long would it take you to establish a 400K practice, right? that's profit, not total revenue.
Right.
So that would be
Because as an employee, you get benefits too.
Yeah.
A lot of times they help them with their student loans as well. I mean, I think the era of entrepreneurial physicians is ending. I mean, look at the people coming out of med school.
I don't know if it ever really started, Dan. I mean,
well,
it had a boom period.
Yeah, physicians inherently are, you know, at least in my experience, aren't the greatest business.
But private practices were booming at one point.
But some of them are. So there will always be some private practices because some people like to be self-employed, right? They want to make their own schedules. They don't want to have to answer to anybody. So I think there will always be private practices, but they certainly will be minuscule compared to what they used to be.
Yeah, and I research, mean, liability, overhead, staffing, insurance.
Research gives a lot of these guys and gals their second chance. Because let's say you go out of med school, you go work for Kaiser for 10 years, right? You paid off all your loans, you're good. But you're like, hey, I don't like this question right here or this comment. I don't want to be controlled by private equity-owned healthcare system. So now they're looking, hey, maybe I can start a private practice. So now I see research. Research is often the second chance. To be an entrepreneur. And we do see a lot of that, especially near the semi-retirement age. You see that where hey, I wish I would have done this, but I still have a chance. Research is a way to do it. You do see that, but I wish we see more of it from a younger age. And it's just a wish. I mean, the reality is large healthcare systems are dominating prices, insurance reimbursements. Robert, they can negotiate. The doctor I visit here in Yuma, he's not my PI.
Mm-hmm.
He competes with Smith, so he doesn't. I wouldn't work with him, but right. He's telling me there's no point to even keep private practice open anymore.
Right.
Is it the large health systems driving down all the reimbursement rates because they're negotiating their own rates, and they know it's just like Walmart. Walmart knows if the private grocery store across the street selling this for $3, we're gonna sell it for $1 until they go out of business.
Yep.
And then we'll raise it back up to $3.
And then Amazon's gonna put Walmart out of business.
Yeah, the cycle just gonna continue. But that's the state that they're dealing with. So they have to do all these other things like weight loss, which is all cash, right? Cash.
You know what the new big thing is. Concierge medicine, Dan, is popping up.
Yeah,
I mean, it's you know, you got to pay an initiation fee, you know, $2,000 a month, and this doctor will come to your house, office.
Yes,
they'll come remove a hangnail at 2 o'clock in the morning. Yep. I mean, it's kind of really a sad state of affairs, to be quite honest.
They're doing their own insurance.
Yeah, well, now it's the haves and the have-nots, you know, and the people who need healthcare and are susceptible to, you know, otherwise, bad things don't have the access to the healthcare because you call up any specialist right now. You don't even need to have insurance wherever you live, and try and get an appointment this week.
Yeah, good luck.
I'm sorry, Dr. So and So's booked out 2 months.
You're lucky you get a receptionist.
Yeah, good luck. Exactly. So you know it's kind of and think about Canada. Right. 10, 15 years ago, you hear about, I have a lot of friends in Quebec and Montreal, Alberta, Toronto, and I talk to them and they're like, Robert, I need an MRI or a CT. I have to wait 3 months. Yep. I'm like, you could be dead by the time you get the CT scan.
Yep.
You know, especially for whatever ailment it is.
Yeah. Especially with some sort of nearing terminal illness.
Exactly. And so I'm just saying it's very broken. System. And you know, it's funny, I just read an article this morning on LinkedIn. It was a physician who was a PD. I wish I would have had his name, because what a great guy. Jonas, Dr. Jonas something, or Jonah, Dr. Jonah Essers or something, man. This is a physician. Okay. He wrote an article this morning, Dan, and I'm just telling Chris about it, where he's a pediatric gastroenterologist specializing in pediatric IBD, Okay. Crohn's, whatever, autoimmune disorders with the, you know, irritable bowel disorders for pediatrics. And he has, you know, some of these pediatric patients on biologics, and a certain insurance provider, I'm not going to, you know, mention the name because I don't think it's relevant. If you want to look at the
letter, who cares? They all would act the same way.
All the same way. Denied him a lab test and stuck the parents, who were ended up in tears. He wrote this long article for $560, which was very impactful to this particular family. This child was on this, you know, biologic medication for their disorder, you know, their IBD disorder. And standard of care predicates this physician for ordering a specialty lab test to check titers against an antibody level to ensure that he's not overdosing or underdosing this pediatric patient. The insurance company denied his request and order, number one. Then he went to bat and went back. His nurse spent over 6 hours writing an appeal, which also got denied. Then the doctor stepped in for a third time and said, I want a peer-to-peer, meaning he wants to speak to a comparable physician who represents the insurance company to explain his case on why he was denied for this particular lab order. And they denied his peer-to-peer request. Here's the kicker. After he wrote this letter, it went kind of viral on LinkedIn. It had over 54,000 impressions within the first hour. All of a sudden, when the public was made aware of this terrible situation, because the insurance company called it an experimental lab request, and they don't cover experimental lab. And this was the furthest thing from experimental, right? It's part of standard of care, at least in this physician's expert opinion, in which he is certainly an expert in. Then only after it went viral was he granted a peer-to-peer discussion, you know, to at least pitch his case to potentially get the family who had to cough up $560 in this market to cover this lab range to know whether or not he's adequately treating their child. That's the state of where we are, guys, in healthcare. You know, it's... And again, you can't even get any rhyme or reason why are you denying my request? Why are you denying something that I need to do to be in line with standard of care? And he couldn't get an answer. So when it went viral, he finally got some traction. I mean, it's sad. That's what it takes.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. Couldn't agree more. And that's a great doctor. I can attest to this just recently. Like 4 months ago, my daughter's got some sort of unknown illness, right? It's not life-threatening, but it just makes it difficult for her to go to school. So it's driving mom and dad nuts. And the doctor, her primary care, wanted to run a simple ECG, right? It took 4 months and the doctor 6 requests to get this approved.
Wow.
Right? A simple ECG. Right. And I was like, well, we'll just pay cash. That's what I told my wife. We'll just take it to the clinic and do it. And she's like,
you guys have 12 carts laying on the side.
Yeah,
we're requested to test ECGs on every study anyways.
I even said that to my wife, and I can't remember why, but she said, no, that won't work. We have to do it because I don't remember what she said. But anyhow, they wanted to charge like $1,200 for an ECG. Because I told her, let's just pay for it. And I said, and she was like, no.
That's ridiculous. $1,200.
Let's just get it approved. And it took her like 3 or 4 months of calling the doctor then calling the insurance company to get it approved. Yeah. This stuff's just ridiculous.
It's ridiculous. You know, and I hear it from my provider friends all the time. I got one that works at, you know, Banner Hospital here locally in Arizona. You know, she tells me, Robert, you know, my patients, they can't get the meds they need. You know, they have to get, you know, maybe second or third line because that's what's affordable. There's no reimbursements. Yeah, there's subsidies. You know, there's great apps out there like GoodRx that have coupons and things like that. But, you know, when it's a decision on putting food on the table, gas in the car, paying bills, and or buying your medicine for the sake of your health, you know, people are facing these decisions daily, and with the current job market,
and it's become more common.
Yeah, it's more common. I feel so badly for just where everything is headed, and it's going to take a collective group of folks and a large mass to really turn the tide. And I agree with you guys, Dan, Chris. I mean, it's not getting any better. It's probably going to get worse in terms of, just all these bureaucratic controlled protocols and checklists on the healthcare side. Can doctors truly practice medicine anymore? No, in my opinion. Thank you. I'll say
not even that. Not even in private practice.
They have a protocol.
Well, of course not. Of course not.
They have a protocol created by the insurance companies that they have to follow.
Yep, exactly. And even in private practice, right? I mean,
well, they still have to deal with the insurance companies. Doesn't matter where you're practicing.
Sure, exactly. And then they have to wait, and that's the whole frustration aspect of it. And one thing about private practice I want to mention is, I remember like back in the day when, I would shadow doctors and things like that in the suburbs of Detroit, Michigan and things like that. I'm talking like pre-college days, undergraduate, kind of in like the summertime. That physician who is still a near dear friend of mine and our families, he had a very niche audience because he was a family doctor, but also a psychiatrist. So he kind of took care of the psychiatric aspect and the family medicine aspect at the same time. And he had a huge practice. And he would see at that time, and we're talking early 2000s, late 90s, like maybe 98, 99, he would see 30 to 40 patients a day, and he was doing very, very well, right? Very well, just had his huge, huge house. Fancy schmancy cars, and rules and regulations were maybe a little bit more lax back then, and I was just like, everyone's like, wow, wow, wow. Not to say that's why somebody should go into medicine. Absolutely not. But he was doing well, right? And look at him now today, all right? 25 years later, the man is almost, 70 years old. He's still working, okay? And he has to see now 90 to 100 plus patients a day to make the same amount of money he made in the late 90s, to support the lifestyle and to support his staff, his payroll, his nurses, his rent, his overhead. Yeah. His insurance, all the clinical medical supplies, everything and about it. And he has to hire a specific person, a medical biller, just to chase down the reimbursement stipends that are needed because the bills aren't being paid or the money's
prior
off
person. And
there you go. All of those roles,
all these hurdles.
So Dan, my point in saying all this is very easy to the audience and to you guys. What happens when the volume of patients you have to see goes down? What happens to quality of care?
Yeah, and this is why we need more research opportunities for these sites or for these clinics. I think research is a great add-on to any private practice. And every doctor I've talked to that about this that trust me, so if I come from a referral, they're in it. Like within 10 minutes of the conversation, they're like, yeah, this is great. I can choose what study I want and what patients go. Yeah, you're the PI. You choose. We need you to choose.
That's why the referrals are so important. Because take what the scenario Robert just described, and you're going in there cold. Because I don't have time for you. I got to see 100 patients to pay my bills today.
Exactly. Right?
And not only that, why should I trust you? Right. I don't have time to talk to you.
That's why internal medicine is so important first, and then they'll connect you to all the specialists.
Yep.
But you got to make sure that internal medicine has a good reputation. Yep. If they got a bad one, those specialists are going to say, oh, you work for this person? Oh, no, get away.
And it doesn't necessarily have to be an internal medicine because most specialists have connections. And they have connections to internal medicine doctors or GPs, right? So they can send you there.
Yeah.
So you don't necessarily have to start with a GP because all the doctors are connected. It's just like Dan said, very important they have a good reputation, though.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, guys, my own primary care physician, I went for my, annual wellness exam not too long ago. He looks at me. I mean, this guy's hilarious. I mean, he's very funny. Great bedside manner. Elderly, older gentleman. He's, probably at the tail end of his career, to be honest with you. He's like, do you think you're going to have, when I retire, do you think someone's going to sit here with you for 30 minutes like I do? He literally looked at me and said that. And I'm like, probably not. He's like, this is it. I'm the last guy who does this. You know? And I was like, I was jokingly laughing, but I'm like, you're right. You're right. Yeah. I agree with you.
Should give you a PHQ 9 after that and see how you score.
Seriously,
yeah, you know? It's tough, but I think research is the shining light in all this. Like, when doctors realize, like, we complain, we make memes, okay, yeah, payments, this and that. Research is very fairly compensated. Like, if you negotiate your contract well.
Currently.
I don't see that changing.
It very well could.
Well, anything could, but do you actually see evidence that that's changing?
No, not at this point. But the thing is I'm sure doctors in the 1950s didn't think it would ever change either.
You know what scares me is this whole push towards research as a care option. Get insurance involved. That's one way to screw up a good thing.
Yeah, that will surely change it.
I mean, Dan, it's already here.
For oncology.
I mean, even outside of oncology, like there's insurance parts of NASH studies too. I witnessed
for certain
it
assessments. Certain assessments.
Yeah, but I'm just saying. But whoa, who's? I mean, think about that, right?
I have. Yeah,
it's crazy.
Advocate for it.
Yeah, and then it goes. You know, now it's like, well, what about those who don't have the insurance? Are they completely cut out of this picture? And then what's going on, guys? I really want to, and I'm sorry for bringing the elephant in the room here, but what's going on with DEI? And so many companies eliminating, like, their, like, you know, 12 DEI employees have been fired. I think it happened in Florida recently. Mm-hmm. I mean, what's going on? I mean, it's like counterintuitive. You know, the FDA has published guidance on sponsors requiring to have DEI plans as soon as IND submission or as soon as reasonably possible per the draft guidance. But now, like, companies are just ditching out on employees who focus on this area. I mean, do you guys have any thoughts on this? I was blown away to see
all
that.
It's going to take is the FDA to have great results of a phase 3 study and then look at the demo and say, well, we would have passed it, but unfortunately you didn't have enough Latino, enough African-American, so we deny it. That's what it's going to take for this to be like real change in the D&I space. And I think sponsors realize this and the sites do too, you know, and there's whole organizations dedicated to this. Latinos in Clinical Research was built for this exact purpose, enroll more Hispanic participants in research studies. But as far as like the CROs, or I mean, there's two camps of DE&I. One is let's pay lip service to this idea because people are wanting it and it's the flavor of the month. And the other camp is like the reality of, well, you actually need minorities in trials or we're not approving drugs. There's two different DE&I camps, and one of them is critical. The other one, I think, is virtue signaling with like no real action behind it. And I think that's where you see the layoffs coming are on that side.
Yeah. I mean, because Daniel, you know, when you read the guidance on DEI, you know, it says for sponsors, I mean, if they can't meet the obligations within the plan, they should submit it as reasonably possible. But a lot of sponsors can collect to be in compliance with the guidance, at least. You can collect the DEI requirements in phase 4, which is after NDA approval. So, you know, I'm just saying, like, is this lip service? I don't know. It kind of... You know,
I don't
in my
think
opinion,
any study, pivotal study, has been rejected yet that I'm aware of because of DE&I. But
well,
I think
point.
It's coming. I think it's going to happen.
I hope so.
Yeah. Then we'll see a resurgence in the...
Yeah.
But sites know. Sites already know. And sponsors, now they ask, like, on almost every feasibility, what's your demographic breakdown? Sponsors like Inato ask. It's like front and center on their questionnaires that they ask, because it's they see where the puck is headed, and that is where it's headed, because we need it.
Yeah.
But guys, I gotta give a shout out to Twitter, or X, formerly known as Twitter. They have been like 40 people watching on X formerly nice. On awesome. Twitter.
That's awesome.
So thank you guys. And this is also on YouTube and not on Facebook for once. So thank you guys both for coming on. And, you know, you guys are regular guests. We'll do it again. But good discussions on everything. And we're going to start helping people out on these live streams too. So thank you both, Chris and Robert.
Thank you guys. Have a great one.
Like, subscribe, comment, share. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.